The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And if you do that, our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. As we kind of talk to people each week, we talk to those people who are trying to make our world better and in a variety of ways. And this is the week that the Pope made some news. Hey, Tom, you remember the name of the Pope?
Yes, Monsignor. I think the Pope's name is Francis.
Pope Francis. Okay. Yeah, I think we know the guy's name, right?
I think so.
Yeah, right here, I was predicting when he was elected, and just to show you how good my predictions were, when he chose the name Francis, I said, nah. And everybody said Francis of Assisi. I said, no. He's a Jesuit. It's Francis Xavier. And then he said it was Francis of Assisi, and I said, I think he means Francis Xavier, but anyway. So Pope Francis decided he was going to write a letter.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote a letter,
yes,
big letter,
a big letter,
on a big world too, right?
That's what he wrote about. Absolutely, the whole thing.
So today we're going to talk about that letter. We're going to talk about his letter, and the reason we can talk about it is, and why people have been talking about it for a while, is because, as we did a couple months ago, one of those Roman cardinal type guys, he kind of helped write the thing, mm-hmm. and he was given talks in different places. So he kind of told people what he bet was going to be in it. And, you know, you don't know exactly until it actually comes out. But I think this is one of those encyclicals which has kind of had a lot of pre-press. So when it came out, it really, people kind of said, yes, they find a nice phrase here and there that they weren't expecting, maybe a few nuances. But I think people kind of figured out what was going to be said, mm-hmm. you know, before it came out. So I think that's good. So this week, we're going to be speaking with people who are smart. Smarter than us, Tom, but that's not a high bar for me.
Now
for you, it's a little higher, and for Victoria, it's very high. But we're going to talk first. We're going to talk about Tony Annette, who is working on climate change, sustainable development. He's an advisor to the Earth Institute for Columbia University. Boy, Columbia University's got a big footprint in New York City.
For sure.
So we got to figure out how they're doing. And I will add, it's my alma mater. Mm-hmm. So, and then a little bit later on in the show, we're going to speak with Jim Innes, who is the executive director of Catholic Rural Life Conference, and we're going to speak with both of them about the Pope's encyclical. We're going to figure out what's going on in our world and all types of things like that. So I'm excited. You know, it's not often that encyclicals kind of make the news and people are waiting for them. So this was a big deal. So anyway, but, you know, there's probably more going on in the world than encyclicals and climate and stuff like that. So you got any other news before we go to our first guest, Tom?
We do, Monsignor. You know, another thing that happened that is an anniversary of sorts, not of an encyclical, but of a very important document for Catholic human for human rights in general, is we just passed the 800th anniversary on June 15th, which was a week ago Monday, of the Magna Carta.
That's before even Victoria was born.
It is the before Magna Victoria was born. Yeah. It was.
And Victoria, you know what the Magna Carta is?
I have no idea. Now I do listen to some songs in the artist Jay-Z.
Right.
He has an album called that.
Does
Magna
he?
Carta. Holy Grail, okay. But it's a song.
Magna Carta.
So that's what I know it from.
Okay.
But of course, I'm a bit younger. So
yes, that's right.
You're very young.
Tell me where did it come from.
You know why I like Jay-Z, don't you?
Why?
You know why.
Because he's from New York.
Yeah, and why else?
He has the anthem song for New York.
I like his wife.
Oh, Beyonce.
Yes, Beyonce. Yeah.
That's why. So I invite Jay-Z to any party as long as he brings his wife with. We'll make it a family affair.
Oh, family affair. That's family what we're affair. Calling it these days, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, that's what we're calling it. So anyway.
So what is it?
Oh, what is the Magna Carta? The Magna Carta, just very, very simply, it was Pope...
Hold on for a second. Oh, okay. Magna Carta. It's Latin. Okay? So magnanimous... magnanimity, what's that mean?
Big, a lot.
Big.
The magnitude of it.
Yeah. And kata is like a letter. So it's a big letter. So the Magna Carta was a big letter. So Tom, now that I told her what it means, tell her what it really means.
Okay, very good. Well, back in 1215, there was a king of England named John, and he was not very well liked by the people, not very well liked by his nobles. And there were 25 barons who basically went to King John, and just they didn't like the taxes, they didn't like all the wars that he was waging. So they made him sign this big letter, as Monsignor said. And it includes within it some very important provisions. You know, one of the things, it's the first time that you ever have something trial jury by your peers. And it was the idea that the king wasn't above the law. So it was the idea, it was the very first time that kind of the barons were holding the king accountable. Now, of course, the barons weren't doing it out of the goodness of their heart for their serfs and people. But I mean, as far as they themselves, it was the first time that there was really a check on authority. And so it's really, people trace that to the beginning, if you will, of the human rights cause in the modern world today.
Good job. Good job. Magna Carta, we like it. Good document. The barons got together and they made the king sign the letter and say, hey, you got to do these things or we ain't going to be your loyal fiefs or something like that. Your loyal, exactly. Whatever they are, your loyal barons. So anyway, so listen, I think everybody's so excited about Pope Francis' encyclical. I don't want to waste any more time on this ancient history. I want to talk about contemporary history. And we're just delighted that we have as our first guest, Tony Annette, who is at the works on climate change and sustainable development at the Earth Institute of Columbia University. And he's from went to Trinity College Dublin, and he also got a PhD in economics from Columbia University. Tony, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Monsignor. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Great. I'm delighted that you are here. So, how'd you get involved in this Earth Institute thing?
Okay, let me start at the beginning. Okay. I mean, I was hired by the Earth Institute at Columbia University, specifically the group called the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, SDSN. I was jointly hired by them and an NGO called Religions for Peace, which is the world's largest group that for multi-religious
cooperation. Now, Tony, I got to ask you, do we have another group called Religions for War?
There probably are, but we don't talk about that.
That's good. I'm glad.
We try to not talk about that.
Okay, good.
But I work with these two groups, and specifically, I work on the moral and religious dimensions of climate change and sustainable development.
Wow, that's we're going to get to that because I think that's critical because there's almost nothing in the world today that people don't see through a political lens. And, you know, I always hear the bishops talk. I always hear Cardinal Dolan talk. Well, I'm not speaking as a politician. I'm speaking as a moral leader. I'm speaking about the pastoral dimension. So I'm delighted to hear you that you particularly at the Earth Institute, you're there to kind of bring in ethical or a moral element or component to the conversation. That's great.
No, absolutely. The moral element is, in a sense, the missing element. I mean, everybody knows the science, everybody understands the technology. There's no issue, there's no debate there. But very few people frame this as a moral issue. You even see in the polls, the moral dimension is way down the list in the polls. But I think, you know, Pope Francis is going to have something to say about that and change a few minds.
Now, let me go back a little bit, because it seems to me if I read the newspapers where you began by saying, well, you know, they don't dispute about kind of the facts of the reality, but I understand there's a lot of consensus around global warming or climate change, but a lot of people do dispute it. And even some scientists say, no, I don't buy it at all. Now, okay, maybe we dismiss it, but it's not everybody doesn't seem to accept it.
No, there's a small fringe that doesn't accept it. But I mean, I think we can say that it is a pretty firm scientific consensus. And I mean, it's really hard to argue with the people who deny it because, and I have a friend whose brother-in-law claims that the moon landing was faked. And I said to him, well, that's kind of obvious to prove to him wrong. That's wrong. And he said, well, no, it's impossible because he's done the research. He has an answer to every specific point. Now, I'm not saying that's an equivalent sense of denial, but it's the same kind of issue. The deniers, they've invested so much time in like trying to refute every single little point, there's almost nothing you can say to change their minds.
Right.
Yeah. But I mean, we have the world's top climate scientists are all agreed on this, and you know, they're, to me, the evidence is pretty much indisputable when you look at the simple relationship between greenhouse gas emissions and global temperatures. I mean, you know, we're Catholic. We understand that, you know, faith and reason go together. That there's an intelligibility to the world that we can understand, that we can understand the laws, that when you pump a lot of this carbon, you know, carbon emissions into the atmosphere, temperatures will rise.
Now, Tony, I'm not as smart as you are about this.
And, oh, you're smarter.
And so help me and help our listeners. So we hear about, like, words like the environment. We hear about global warming. We hear about emissions, carbon footprint. We hear all about that stuff. Are they all the same?
Well, yes, kind of. The fundamental issue is really that, you know, there are greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and without those greenhouse gases, this would be a dead planet. We wouldn't be alive. So they keep us alive.
So we like them.
We like them, but you can have too much of a good thing.
Like wine.
And we have...
Like wine.
Yeah, exactly. You can always have too much of a good thing. Right. It's like Aristotle. You have to get the balance between the virtue and the vice.
I think you'd have too much Aristotle.
Yeah. Yes. Some of your priest friends would disagree with you.
Yeah, I know, but, you know.
Yeah.
But no. I can even quote the Latin in Virtus Stat in Media, that virtue stands in the middle.
See, I told you were smarter than me.
Not too much Aristotle, not too much wine, not too much greenhouse gases.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. I mean, look, if you look at the technical term is, you know, they look at parts per million. This is very technical, but it's like, you know, molecules of carbon dioxide per million molecules in the atmosphere. And for the past 800,000 years, really long time, it's between like 150 to 250, 280 parts per million. You know, when the planet's warm, it goes up. When the planet's cold, it's down. You know, ice ages coming in and out. So we are now past 400 parts per million, which is something we haven't seen in 3 million years. And that spike has just happened in the last 150 years. That's the Industrial Revolution. That's the technologies that gave us the Industrial Revolution and the lifestyles we all appreciate have also come with a huge risk. And if you look at this chart and you see that and you understand the relationship between those greenhouse gas emissions and global temperatures, that's what terrifies everybody.
Okay, so let me see if I can translate what you've said. That the percentage went up almost tripled, right? From 150 to 400. Is that what you said?
Well, the 150 was the low point over the It fluctuated between 150 to 280, but I don't think it makes much sense to stick with the numbers of
at least doubled.
I mean, it's substantially higher, and the thing is the trajectory is going up. We're increasing it by about 2 parts per million a year, which might not sound like much, but over 50 years, it's a lot.
You're right, Tony, I got to tell you, it doesn't sound like a lot to me because, you know, two per million, you know. But I guess it does mean a lot?
It does mean a lot, yeah.
Okay, so...
And it'll have a dramatic effect on global temperatures.
Now, again, let me ask a simple question. Is this the same thing that happened why we no longer have glaciers?
Okay. Not really, kind of, but not really.
Okay.
I mean, the ice ages were kind of. I mean, the scientists.
You must be a theologian
and I'm
or
actually, yeah, I'm actually not a scientist. So I'm just telling you all the second hand.
That's all right.
So you know, for like a few million years, the Earth cycled in and out of these ice ages.
Okay.
And the ice ages are really called by changes in the tilts of the Earth's. They call it the wobbles.
Okay.
The Earth revolves around the sun, but it also wobbles.
Okay.
So you get these wobbles, and these wobbles, you know. They change the climate, but we're talking over, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of years.
Okay.
So yes, you get, look, the planet is, was it 4.5 billion years old? This planet has seen everything in 4.5 billion years. We can't even fathom how long that is. What I'm talking about is 150 years. That is nothing in planetary history. And it's really the speed that's the scary part.
Okay, so now for our listeners, we got it. There's big change going on. We're talking with Tony Annette, who is at Columbia University's Earth Institute, and his job there is to bring an analysis that brings in the moral, the ethical dimension to climate issues and climate change. So we understand that we got more particles of bad guy particles, I guess, right?
Bad stuff.
Bad stuff. Okay, yeah. Bad stuff. And now, how's the bad stuff translate to global warming?
Well, that's precisely it. I mean, it's a very direct scientific relationship between the amount of greenhouse gas emissions, these bad stuff in the atmosphere, and global temperatures.
Okay. Now, the Pope says that they're there because we guys did it.
I think
we human guys.
I think, you know, he said in the past that, you know, is it caused by humans? Mostly caused. I mean, there's other stuff going on too. There's change in the solar stuff and volcanoes and everything. But it's mainly humans. And what he's doing there, he is reaffirming the scientific consensus that it's mostly humans.
And so I guess if it's mostly humans, can we do something about it?
Absolutely. Not only can we do something about it, we absolutely have to do something about it.
Boy, now you're a moralist. Now you're a moralist.
Told you that was my job.
Right, okay. We have to go to confession?
Can I see you afterwards? Yeah. No. If we do nothing, global temperatures will rise like 4 to 6 or 7 degrees above pre-industrial levels. That's the way they describe it. Now, again, that might not sound like much, but it actually is. Let's just think
over
of it that way.
Over what period of time?
By the end of the century. By 2100, say.
Victoria, you're going to be alive, so you better worry about this. I'm not going to be alive. So 4 to 7 degrees warmer, on average.
On average,
right?
Exactly. Okay. On average. Now, I want you to think about something.
Okay.
So far, global warming has been about less than 1% since before the Industrial Revolution. Less than 1%. You might say, less than 1%. That's not a big deal.
Right.
And, you know, for most of us, it's not a big deal. Not too big. And you see, it doesn't stop, you know, the extreme weather events we get here in New York or in the Philippines or in the heat waves in India and stuff like that. But where it really hits hard is in the regions of the world that are already vulnerable to drought.
Ah.
And I want to mention two regions.
Please.
One is the Sahel region in West Africa, which is a very dry region. Doesn't have much water anyway. So any kind of drought is going to have dreadful.
Tell me some countries.
Northern Nigeria, Chad, that kind of area.
Okay.
So England. So what's happening is the desert is encroaching south. The Sahara Desert is moving south as the drought is increasing. A big lake called Lake Chad is pretty much dried up.
Wow.
So the pastoralists, the people who earn their living, you know, with herds and pastoraling, are moving south because they have no land, they have no way of surviving, and they're encroaching on farmland. So conflict is arising. Now here's the added problem: most of those pastoralists are Muslims. Most of those farmers are Christians. So you see all this Muslim Christian tension in Nigeria. Now is it only caused by drought and climate change? No, of course not. There are other causes, but it's a huge background factor that people are ignoring.
Here's what I'm betting, Tom. See if we're right on this. No, I bet you it's close to the 10th parallel. Mm-hmm. And because we had a guest on a year or so ago who's written a book. Was the book called The 10th Parable?
It was, Monsieur. It was The 10th Parallel.
Yeah, and what she did is she documented that if you went across the 10th parallel north, the equator, that in so many parts of Africa and Asia, it was kind of the place where Muslims and Christians lived in close proximity.
Yeah, that's probably right. Yeah.
And that's where you get a lot of tensions when people live in close proximity. So that's fascinating. So the shepherds, the people with the herds, are now taking on the farmland, and the farmland people don't like it.
You're right.
Okay.
And also, a lot of people are moving to cities, but you know, the cities, there's not much, very little economic opportunity, very little hope in the cities. So these young people fall prey to recruiters from Boko Haram and groups like this.
Yeah.
So it all feeds into the same cycle. The other example I wanted to give was Syria. We all know the tragedy in Syria, the horrible civil war and the carnage. But what most people don't realize is that the backdrop to that war and carnage and conflict is probably the biggest drought in recorded history. Some scientists even say the biggest drought since the dawn of the agricultural revolution back since civilization began. And again, this is, you know, the Mediterranean and the Near East is one of those regions in the world that's very vulnerable to drought. It's going to be one of the first regions hit. And again, this is only, the global temperatures have only risen by 1%. What happens when they hit 4 to 6%? It's terrifying.
And what about in the United States, California? Is this part of the whole thing?
well, you know, California is also an extremely dry region, and it is actually frightening there too, because if you see what's going on with the aquifers, I mean, people are taking more water out than they're putting back in. They're not replenishing these ancient aquifers, and that's frightening.
Yeah. Now, again, this is a question that I'm just curious about, because I've always found in life is that, you know, sometimes things are good for some people, not good for other people. Is there any opposite side of this, where it's too cold and it's getting a little warmer and those people are doing a little better?
Well, you know, I suppose, you know, the people in the very north of Norway and Sweden, you know, might be a little bit happier. But really, when you think about a 4-degree world or a 6-degree world and the actual convulsions that would happen because of that, it's hard to say anybody would be better off from this.
Okay, that's good. So, all right. So, Tony, what do we do about it?
Well, I think the answer is we reduce our carbon emissions. With the technical term, we decarbonize. Deep decarbonization.
Now, again, help me, because, okay, let's do it. I'm not gonna carbonize, but I'm not aware I'm carbonizing now. So, I mean, how do I stop carbonizing?
Well, it's
Victoria, you carbonizing? Right. See that?
Well, it's actually very simple.
Okay.
Well, there's a number of dimensions. You know, you want to make the energy use, make it more efficient.
Okay.
You know, remember the light bulbs? Make the energy use more efficient.
Okay.
It's quite simple. The second thing is, you know, when you have electricity, and we all need electricity, and the fact that there are 1.3 billion people in the world without power, without electricity, should be of great concern to us. So we know that that's valuable for human life and flourishing. But can we move away from the carbon sources of electricity, like wind, solar, even nuclear? Let's go there. So low carbon sources of electricity. We have the technology. We know how to do this. We just need the political will and to overcome the vested interests.
Now, is it cheaper?
It's getting cheaper.
It
would be a lot cheaper if fossil fuels weren't so heavily subsidized. That's the thing. And you think of it in terms of jobs. I mean, there are, again, something most people probably don't realize is there are more jobs in the United States today in solar than in coal, a lot more. But you don't see this. You don't see the solar industry lobbying Congress, right? It's just very different. So energy efficiency, switch to low carbon and electricity. And then the third one is fuel switching. You know, stop burning fossil fuels directly and move to electricity and things like cars and boilers and things like
now,
that.
Somebody told me, I think we had a guest or somebody called in a while ago saying, you know, if you go to some other form of creating electricity, you're using other stuff to create that, and that's dealing with the environment.
That, you know, there might be some issues there.
Okay.
But I mean, look, if you look at these, what they call the deep decarbonization pathways, countries are doing this. You can measure your carbon emissions, and you know you can figure out a way to get to. Basically, you need to. Here's the scary part. You know, the global economy today is huge. It's like $90 trillion or something like that. It could be in 50 years' time, it could be three times as big.
Right.
Right. Because we want all the developing countries to catch up. That's only fair. So while that's happening, we also need energy efficiency to improve by half. We need to reduce our carbon emissions by half. Now, that's really hard. That's hard. So we know we have the technology. We know how to do it. The scale is going to be daunting. And that's why it has to be done through an international agreement at the global level. And I believe and I hope that Pope Francis is going to speak about this in his encyclical. He's mentioned it before. He won't talk about the details about keeping temperatures at 2 degrees and all that stuff. That's not his job. But I do think that the only way to do this is to get that binding agreement, and all countries need to sign up to this, and the richer countries need to help the poorer countries adapt to climate change. It's all part of the same thing.
Now, is there any role in the future for fossil fuel?
Well, look, there'll be a transition role, but in the long term, I think, you know, the answer is no. I think we have
so
to.
So let me ask this, and I mean, I ask it because one of the things that the encyclical affirms is that creation is good, and that God made good things.
Yeah.
So didn't God make fossil fuels?
God made fossil fuels. Yeah.
So there's got to be some good role for them.
But look, the last 150 years, we've seen the living standards increasing. Mm-hmm. at a scale and a speed and a level that we've never seen before. And that's predominantly due to the Industrial Revolution, which in turn was powered by the energy of fossil fuels. So fossil fuels have been good for us.
Right.
And I'm not, you know, I mean, Patriarch Bartholomew said that, you know, climate change is a sin. And I mean, has it been a sin to use? You're the priest. I'll ask you: has it been a sin to use fossil fuels to get where we are? I don't think you can say that. But I think, given what we know today about what the future looks like, I think it's a moral imperative to change course.
Okay, and I guess I'm pushing because I just don't know this. I'm not a scientist. I'm not like you.
I'm
talk,
not a scientist.
Yeah, but you listen to them more than I do. You get paid to listen to them, I mean, one of the things somebody talked to us about a while ago, they talked about catalytic converters on cars. That, in other words, that everybody said they were going to put the auto industry out of business, but in fact, putting them in cars has reduced emissions substantially over the past, 20 years, Tom, was it, or something like that?
Yeah. I think about 20, 25 years ago.
So I guess we got to change what we're doing, but I guess some of it may be like doing things better and more efficiently, not eliminating everything.
I mean, look, we need better technology. We need to put money into research and research and development, which we're not that spending much on. But you're right. We need the technology. We need to be able to do this, because once the technology advances, the cost will fall and it'll become affordable for everybody.
Okay, so we're going to make you now we have a few more minutes, and thank you for taking the time. We're speaking with Tony Annette, who is with the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and he's trying to bring a moral dimension to the scientific world that he deals with there. And we're going to make him czar for the next couple of minutes. And you can, you get three things that you can dictate to the world to make our world better, to change course, okay?
Three things.
Right.
Okay, in that case, I'm going to say a successful outcome to the three major global conferences in 2015.
Okay.
You give me three things, I'm taking three things.
Good.
The first was in July in Addis Ababa, which is the Financing for Development conference. Let the developed countries of the world properly support the developing countries in their process of development, and especially in how they, mitigate and adapt to climate change.
To our listeners, what we traditionally would have been talking about, foreign aid.
Partly foreign aid. Yeah, it's part. And
so
other,
that's one.
Yeah, right. So two is a successful outcome to when all countries, all 193 countries of the UN, adopt the Sustainable Development Goals in September and transform the way they look at their economies from, a very limited view of economic growth as the accumulation of wealth and resources, to a more holistic and encompassing and more ethical view of development, as encompassing not just economic growth, but also social inclusion.
I think there are seven ones in that second one there.
Social inclusion and environmental sustainability. There are actually 17 goals, but I won't mention them because you only mentioned them. So that's two. So the sustainable development goals. And the third one will be a successful outcome at the Paris climate talks this December, when countries have really a last chance. I mean, the scientists say if global warming goes above 2 degrees, all bets are off. 2 degrees is not safe. We already are going to have major upheavals and disruptions
but
with 2 degrees.
But over what period of time?
Over the next century.
Oh.
Yeah, over the next century.
Okay.
So, we think it could be faster. You just never know, because there are all these, I'm not going to get into the science, but there are these feedback mechanisms, and once triggered, can speed up the process and accelerate it. But let's not go there.
And you get one more thing. What should a family in the United States do and Victoria, we're going to learn what we're going to do, because we got to decarbonize. So if a family wants to decarbonize, I'll give you one or two things they should do.
But that's a really interesting point, because I think this is what Pope Francis is not going to just talk about the politics. I think Pope Francis is going to call
for a
conversion
about
of heart.
Pope Tony. So, well, Pope Tony, what do you want to do?
That's even more frightening than climate change.
It is, but give us what should a family do?
Well, have an ecological sensitivity about their family's carbon footprint on the land. Just there's no point telling people. I don't think it's helpful to tell people to, you know, stop using air conditioners or stop driving so much and things like this. But just get into the frame of mind where you adopt these kind of ecological virtues, going back to Aristotle again, that you have a habit of thinking about this, and it's no longer an afterthought or something you don't think about, but it's foremost in your mind that this matters.
And I get, and I don't disagree with you, but to me, I'm not sure I got time for all that stuff, but you want me to change my light bulbs, or you want me to recycle, or you want me to take the subway and not drive? Give me two things that I should do.
All that stuff is good. Actually, you're good because you're a New Yorker. New Yorkers' carbon footprints are a lot less than the rest of the country because we live in apartments and we take public transport.
Okay.
So become more like New Yorkers. How about that?
Tony, that's great. Tony Annette, who is a consultant for ethical, moral issues on global sustainability for the Earth Institute.
Hey, and Religions for Peace.
Yeah. And peace, too. Yeah. And Religions for Peace. I forgot that. And actually, because the religious community has been a big proponent of these things. So, hey, Tony, thank you so much for being with us. I'm so grateful and best of luck with your work. And thank you for raising up these issues. They're critically important.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Absolutely delighted. And I hope everybody enjoys the encyclical.
Great. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. Welcome back. This is our weekly conversation about the Church and the world on Just Love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, Pope Francis has done a great job in capturing the attention of the world, and boy, somebody who can capture the attention of the world with a 192-page document must be doing something right. And so we're delighted this week to kind of talk about the environment in light of his encyclical, and we're talking with people who know a lot more about it than I do. And so that's what our conversation is about this week, and in a few minutes we're going to speak with our next guest, who is Jim Innes, who is the executive director of the Catholic Rural Life Conference. And I think for those of us who live in urban areas, it's important that we hear from people who, you know, have more than concrete, asphalt, subways and buses and things for our neighbors, that, you know, there's a big spacious part of our world, and there are places where people don't live too close together. So I'm glad that Jim Innes is going to be with us in a few minutes to talk to us about his perspective on this. So, Tom, any other news you got this week?
Yeah, well, you know, Monsignor Pope Francis did more than just release an encyclical this week. He actually...
We don't care.
No, we don't care about
this. This is encyclical. He only gets one thing a week.
He gets one thing a week.
One thing a week.
I would say he did actually speak to a general conference about the Food and Agricultural Association at the UN.
Yeah, we'll give him it's related.
It is related. It's related. Yes, okay. I would say so. He did. So he spoke about that, and actually, he also commented a lot about the influence of financial markets on hunger. And he mentioned something that you and Tony were talking about before, Monsignor. He actually mentioned how currently people are using staples like corn and rice to sort of augment some of the energy. You know, I would say they're using it for biofuels. And the Pope didn't come out and say that that should not happen, but he said it's worrying to know that a quantity of agricultural products used for other ends, perhaps good ends, but which are not in the immediate ends of the hungry, are problematic from a moral perspective. So I think what the Pope is sort of saying is we have to be sure that people are fed and that people are clothed and that people have the necessities before we start using agricultural products for other things like fuel.
Ah, well, you know, one of the things is that in the past couple of years, when they've used a lot of corn in this country, they've converted that to use, I think, for ethylene.
Ethylene, exactly. Right.
Ethylene,
yes, right.
And that caused the prices of food to go up.
Exactly.
Because corn's used for so much stuff. So, yeah, hey, another, can we give an applause for the Pope
yeah,
for he got
give,
that?
Yay.
Okay, he did good.
He did okay. Very, very good as far as that goes.
Okay, you got anything else?
I do. You know, from a perspective of kind of some good news, you know, we always share some troubling news. Out in Duquesne University, out in Pittsburgh, there's an interesting thing that they wind up doing out there. Every year, Monsignor, what they do is they increase what is the effective minimum wage at their university. So, for example, this year, as of July 1st, 2015, Duquesne has an effective new minimum wage of $16 per hour. And it's up from last year when they had it at $15 per hour. And the new wage will increase the wages of all the university's lowest paid workers, which is their maintenance, clerical, and security staff. And it sets a pattern that the university increases the minimum wage every year. And, of course, we know the current federal minimum wage and the minimum wage in Pennsylvania is currently $7.25 an hour. So as a decision, they decided to increase the minimum wage for all of their workers up to almost twice that.
Pretty good. Pretty
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
So, listen, I got two little quotes, Victoria, for the Pope's encyclical on the environment. Okay?
I'm listening.
Okay, so, what about these big plants? You know, do we like them? We don't like them.
What big plants?
Well, here's my thing. We like big plants, but big plants for food, not for pollution.
Oh, you said plant.
Plant.
See, I'm thinking you saying plants.
Plants.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were saying.
I did, plants. But some plants grow food and some plants pollute.
Okay, yeah.
You know, like plant factories.
Right, okay.
But
yes.
Like plants in the ground, they create food, so it depends. We like the big plants if they create food.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like the big plants if they
Because
pollute.
I love food now. I love me some food.
Oh, we know. We
oh,
know.
Oh, my goodness. I
we
love food.
Know. And the other thing is, we got to save the whales.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We got to save the trees.
Mm-hmm.
But we got to save the people. We got to save the people first and foremost, because people are made in God's image and likeness. So I think what the Pope's encyclical is about is we save the whales, we save the trees, and we make sure we save the people, because
Absolutely.
It's the people that count. So,
aha!
Like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you say we take a break, and then we'll go to our guest. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in a few minutes on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. We're speaking this week about the environment because Pope Francis wrote a big letter, and his letter really has gotten a lot of publicity. And so we're kind of talking about the topic of the environment and human development. And we're going to speak right now with Jim Ennis, who is the executive director of Catholic Rural Life. Hey, Jim, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Monsignor. It's my pleasure.
Great. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what is the Catholic Rural Life Conference, or is that, tell us about that.
Sure. Catholic Rural Life is a 92-year-old Catholic organization founded by Father Edwin V. O'Hara, who went on to become Archbishop Edwin V. O'Hara. And he founded it because he saw a need to reach out both through evangelism and discipleship and continued advocating on behalf of folks in rural communities. Now, back in 1923, half the population lived in rural communities, but we still have over 50 million people living in rural communities. So we have a ministry reaching out and representing the concerns of rural America.
So give us a sense. What'd you say? What year was it that half the people were living in rural America?
Yeah, 1923, 50% of the U.S. population lived in rural America, and that was about 52 million people in 1923. Well, about the same number of people live in rural America now, about 51 million people. It represents about 16% of our population now.
So it's decreased by about two-thirds.
In terms of percent, but the actual numbers are still about the same. About, over 50 million people still live in rural America. And many of them are farmers who supply our food and grow our food. But there are also, millions of Americans who are from rural America and love rural America and rural at heart and are still concerned with what's happening in rural America.
Now, with regard to that, what I hear all the time is that kind of the number of farmers is decreasing, family farms decreasing because it's being taken over by, big mega agricultural companies. But I just want to make sure myself and our listeners understood what you said. You're saying there's the same number of farmers now as there was in 1950?
No. I'm sorry. I'm saying the same number of Americans, people living in rural America.
Yeah. But what about the farms?
Well, in the farms, we've got 2.2 million farms out in rural America.
Okay.
In 1960, we had about 4.4 million. So, yes, we've seen the number of farms decrease by half over the last, 50-plus years.
Now, I don't want to get too technical on that, but what's the relationship to the acreage back then and now?
Well, it's increased. I mean, the average acreage is about 387 acres per farm on average. Back in the 1960s, it was about 180 acres.
So basically, you have the number of farms and double the acreage, and in my simple math, it means we got the same number of acres being farmed just by half the number of people.
Correct, and a lot of that is because of technology. Mechanization, able to, plant seeds, 32 rows planting seeds instead of 8 rows. So all of a sudden, with one machine, you can do 4 times the amount of work based on the increased technology that we've seen over the last 50-plus years.
Now, let me ask you a question. In light of our previous guest was talking about fossil fuels, we're talking about climate change, the Pope's encyclical on the environment. Now, in light of that big change, is the new change in technology, is that kind of better for the Earth or equal or worse? How's that technology affecting what we're doing with the environment?
Well, that's a really important question. And
that's all we ask on this show. And that's why we get smart people like you who can answer the important questions.
Well, the answer is complicated. But I knew that was coming next. I know. But let me explain here.
Okay.
There are a number of things here. One is, the Catholic Church affirms farmers and that we need
They happen to be people, so we affirm people.
We affirm people, right. We affirm life, and we need to eat, and we, you know, it's really important around being food secure and able to access food. What's happening with the industrialization of agriculture, that farms are becoming larger. Now, the average is 387 acres, but what you'll see on the landscape is farms of 10,000 acres and 5,000 acres. You'll see livestock operations that now have very, very large confinement operations that have, you know, again, real challenges in terms of manure management. What's happening on the landscape in environment is that you're seeing some soil and water contamination that have raised concerns from upstate New York to California. And I'll just give you one example. In the San Joaquin Valley, where I'm from, and that's in California, you've got...
Is that near Fresno?
It's Fresno's right in the center of the San Joaquin Valley. So it goes from Bakersfield up to Sacramento. And,
right.
But you've got, it's one of the most productive valleys in the country in terms of our fruits and vegetables come from. But you've got very, very high levels of nitrates in the groundwater. And what happens is that nitrate contamination is widespread, according to this report.
Now, remember, I don't know this stuff, so nitrates are bad guys?
Well, what happens is nitrate is a common contaminant. It's also a natural occurring chemical. But what happens is that people also add nitrate to the environment in the form of fertilizers. And so what you've got is percolation of nitrates down into the groundwater that people depend on for drinking water. So according to a UC Davis study, this came out in 2012, you've got an area of that has about 2.6 million people living in these two valleys, the valley of San Joaquin Valley and the adjacent valley, the Salinas Valley. And they depend on this groundwater for drinking water. And they have some of the highest levels of nitrates were found in these wells located in rural communities, many of them low-income communities. And they can't afford the filtration, the expensive filtration systems. So you've got a potential high exposure level. That's happening in California. It's happening in Minnesota. It's happening in Iowa. And across the land, in both in surface water, lakes and streams, but also groundwater.
Now, let me see if I understood this, Jim. So basically, you got some nitrate naturally in the soil.
Correct.
When you throw fertilizer and stuff on it, that adds some additional nitrates, which is, in my words, too much. The too much then gets into the drinking water, and in order to make it safe to drink, you have to spend a lot on filterization to do it, and if you don't, then that's not good for the people who drink it?
Correct. And simplifying it, that you know, the nitrate levels are increased by the use of fertilizers, animal waste, and so they're and also percolates down into the groundwater, but it also runs off into streams and rivers. Now, some of the causes of this, primarily about 96% of it is caused by agriculture. So what the concern is that is how to reduce that runoff or how to reduce the overload. And there are a number of strategies that land-grant universities across the United States are working on to do just that and help farmers do that. What I'm saying is that, though, on the landscape right now, there's a real concern about the soil and water contamination because of some of these large industrialized practices that are a concern across the United States. And so these are USDA is funding research around this. The land-grant universities are working on it. But it is a major concern. It's just one of the concerns related to what's happening as a result of larger and larger farms on the landscape.
So tell us what are some other kind of environmental concerns about the 50 million or so people living in rural America?
Well, also we're experiencing some very, very significant and record-breaking droughts as a result of change in climate. And so California, my home state, where I originally was from, is going through one of the worst droughts in its history. And what's happened is over 4 years, aquifers are being drained. There's more drawing upon groundwater and because of lack of rain and lack of snow fall that they're used to and historically. And so this is, again, a major concern for farmers, because obviously they depend upon water and upon rains for their crops, and so this is a major concern. And you know, the Pope's letter on the environment couldn't be more timely to really call all Christians and Catholics especially their attention to, you know, how we can better, you know, both till and keep the earth, you know, for both our generation but for future generations. So water and use of water and drought issues are major concerns.
So in this country, and if we focus on agriculture, let's just say that particular issue, and as I usually say to my guests, if we kind of made you the czar of agricultural policies, what are two or three things you would do in order to kind of make things better in terms of not doing some of those negative stuff that you were talking about?
Well, you know, through public policy, we have a farm bill that's debated every 5 years and revisited every 5 years. It's a $500 billion farm bill, and you've got $500 billion. Now, right now, about 75% of that farm bill goes to food stamps and food programs. But that other 25 to 30% goes to farm programs to help increase research, you know, paying for research around maybe more sustainable approaches to agriculture. So if more funding could be targeted to that research around creating buffer strips to reduce erosion, to reduce runoff, other strategies to hold soil in the ground by, you know, cover crops and continued strategies. But that's a very, very small percent of that overall budget currently. And we advocate on behalf of the church, and we educate Catholics around the country about how important that is every 5 years to speak to your local representatives about why the church is concerned around a sustainable approach to agricultural practices. And farmers are too, and we want to support them. But what we also is provide some incentives, and that's a real key policy issue around the farm bill that's debated every 5 years. And we just passed one in 2014, and that it'll come back up in 2018-19.
Jim Innes, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love. And I think you've raised the consciousness, my consciousness certainly, and I'm sure of our listeners, about how we need to pay attention to our farms. We need food, and we need to make sure that they are, the agriculture there is in a way that it's not polluting, that it's not causing danger. So, Jim, thanks for your work with Catholic Rural Life, and continue it, and thanks for what everybody in rural life is doing, especially the farmers, to make sure that we can eat. So, Jim, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Monsignor.
Jim Innes is the executive director of Catholic Rural Life. It's been around for 92 years. And, you know, we've been talking about the environment and stuff like that. But I want to have one other conversation before we go. So, Victoria, what do you think? Should LeBron have gotten the most valuable player award? What do you think?
You put me on the spot, huh?
Yeah. What do you think?
I, as I always say to people, LeBron James is the best player for this generation now playing the game. But for last night, them losing, he did not deserve the MVP award. Stephen Curry definitely deserved that. Now, I don't know if it should have been neck and neck with Stephen Curry and Andre, I can't pronounce his last name, Andre Iguodala. I don't know if he should have gotten neck and neck, but he did play his heart out. Both of them did, definitely.
And so what about for the whole series?
Stephen Curry, I still think he deserves the MVP.
Okay.
I definitely believe that.
Okay. So, okay, you said LeBron's the best of this generation.
Yes.
What about all time?
Of all time, no. LeBron James is not the best of all time.
Who's the best?
I believe Michael Jordan is the best of all time, not LeBron James. Kobe Bryant, I've never been a fan of Kobe Bryant, but Kobe Bryant, he does play his heart out. But Kobe Bryant couldn't touch LeBron James.
Well, I think I like Kobe. Now, but
yes, like Kobe.
But I'm not saying he's better than LeBron or better than Michael Jordan.
Right.
But do you think Michael would take LeBron? On
yes.
One on one.
I mean, not if they were at the same age, like
same
right,
age.
They was the same age.
One on one. Yeah, Michael.
I think Michael Jordan would be able to do it. Definitely.
What's he got that LeBron doesn't? Where would he beat him?
Michael Jordan, he has the mind, and it's beyond the skills. You have to have the mind. You have to know how to play the game. For instance, Stephen Curry, when he was playing, he had a mind for it. He knew where the passes were going to go. He knew what was going on, so he was prepared to make his movement.
Okay. Well, listen, so we now got our real expert on that. So listen, great week for Pope Francis, great week for all of us, and the environment is critically important. But as Pope Francis reminds us, the environment exists for people, particularly those people who are left out. We need to make sure that the earth supports them. Good air, good food for those who don't have enough. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Join us again next week when we talk about how we can love ourselves, love our world, and love one another. The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.